This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
In Keeping the Faith today, we're talking with Titus Peachy in Pennsylvania by phone. Titus will, however, be in person here in Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates at the University of Illinois. Is that later this week, Titus?
That's correct. That's on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the University Y.
University YMCA on the corner of Wright Street and Chalmers, 1001 South Wright, if you want to put that in your little GPS. In the evening, parking is free in university parking lots, so it's would be easy to get to hear Titus Peachy this Thursday night at the University of Y. You're going to be talking about cluster bombs. Now, why would anybody want to hear about such a horrible thing?
Well, why not? It's part of it's sadly part of our national history that continues to have an impact on people around the world today in very real ways, so it's important that we know about it.
Now, you first encountered cluster bombs, I read, when you were in Laos back in the early 80s?
That's correct. My wife, Linda, and I worked there from 1980 to 1985, and cluster bombs were a big part of the reality there, so that's where we learned a lot about them.
Who placed the cluster bombs in Laos?
Well, cluster bombs were dropped there during the Vietnam War time period. Rather than sending U.S. troops to fight on the ground in Laos, there was a long 9-year secret air war by the U.S. against communist forces in Laos, and that's when the cluster bombs were dropped by the millions.
How much earlier had these weapons been invented, and who used them first?
Well, I think the very first time they were used was near the end of World War II by the Germans. There were a few other instances when they were used in wars since then, but the first mass use of cluster bombs in warfare was during the Indochina Wars, with the U.S. using them in Laos and Cambodia and in Vietnam.
There is currently at the University of YMCA a series of posters that have been supplied by your organization that talk about cluster bombs and their history. And they did put them up a little early since they knew I'd be talking with you by phone today live here on WILL. And so that display is available even today up till 10 o'clock tonight, Sunday the 23rd. For people who would like to follow up with some more detailed information than perhaps they can get from listening to this program. So that's available at the Y today, and that will be there. Oh, let's see from my notes. How long will that display be there? Ah, through the 28th of October. And you're speaking, so it'll be this week, through
That's
this
correct.
Week, and you'll be there Thursday, and it'll disappear after Friday. But I stopped by and saw it on my way to the station this afternoon, and it's a lot of very good information. And there's also a way that people can respond to try to affect the U.S. political decisions about things like the use of and manufacture of of these horrible, horrible weapons. But we'll get to that in a minute. Tell us, first of all, why are they so bad?
Well, cluster bombs, maybe I should describe a little bit what they are first.
Please.
They come in a large bomb container, or they can also be delivered in an artillery shell or a rocket. And it's a big container, and the container opens in midair over the target area, supposedly. And then hundreds of these small little cluster bomblets fall out and spread over a wide area as they fall to the ground. Some of them are about the size of a tennis ball. Some of the newer ones are shaped more like a soda can, a long soda can. And then there are some that are as small as a size D battery. And they're designed so that when they hit the ground, they're supposed to blow up and spread shrapnel through the air at ballistic speeds. Some of them also have shaped charges that can penetrate armor. They're really dreadful weapons for two primary reasons. The first reason is they are difficult to target. as I said, you know, there are hundreds of them that fall from the container, and they spread out over a wide area. Most of them are not guided weapons, so they're very difficult to pinpoint target, and they often hit things outside the target area when they fall. The second way that they're indiscriminate is that many of them fail to explode when they hit the ground, but that doesn't mean that they're still not lethal. They could remain lethal for years, and the ones that were dropped in Laos 30, 40 years ago are still lethal and still harming people. And so you have this effect of a minefield continuing to exist long after a war has been over because of the high percentage of cluster bomblets that did not blow up. In Laos, they estimate maybe 30% did not blow up when they hit the ground. And so since they dropped 260 million, that leaves millions and millions of them still on the ground after the war, and they continue to harm and kill long after a war is over. And they're killing people that nobody intended to target.
Where have cluster bombs been dropped or used recently?
The U.S. has used them. They used them in the first Gulf War in Iraq and Kuwait. Used them again in Kosovo and Serbia during that conflict in the late 1990s. Used them in the invasion of Afghanistan. And used them again in the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003. Russia and Georgia used them in their conflict most recently, and Israel used them in the conflict they had with Lebanon, I think in 2006 or 2007. I forget the exact year there. So those are some recent conflicts where they've been used, and the results are very similar. Large numbers of unexploded duds left over that continue to harm people.
Why are cluster bombs such a popular weapon in the military arsenals today?
Well, a military person would be the best person to answer that. From what I understand, they're considered very strategic and very useful because you can hit a large target area with one pass of the airplane. Since there are hundreds of the bomblets that are released from one bomb, it can cover a wide area. So if there's a massing of tanks or a massing of troops, anti-aircraft site, one pass of an airplane that drops several cluster bombs can cover a wide area in a short time and destroy the equipment and injure or kill the soldiers that are there. So by making one pass of the airplane, you don't expose the pilot to multiple passes to try to pinpoint the target and destroy what's there.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today about the problem of cluster bombs in our world today with Titus Peachy. Titus, you talked about your experience in Laos, and you've mentioned already that you're not a military expert. You're rather a person who's seen the effects of these bombs on people, on civilians, on children, and have been trying to organize folks to respond and influence their governments to outlaw this particular weapon. Tell us a little bit about your history. Why do you care?
Okay. Well, my wife and I worked for Mennonite Central Committee in Laos from 1980 to 1985. And as I mentioned, traveling throughout the villages of northern Laos, we saw the cluster bomb containers in the villages being used for fence posts, for feeding troughs for cattle, for planters for vegetables and herbs. And often we would see on the side of the container a tag that had the name of the U.S. corporation that had produced the cluster munitions. So there in remote villages where there was no electricity, no modern equipment or technology, we found these references to corporate America. So it felt like there was representation of our own country, our own identity in those villages in a very harmful way because we kept meeting people that had been injured or had family members killed by these cluster bombs. When we returned to the U.S., much to our surprise, we discovered that here in Lancaster County, my wife's home area.
In Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, that's right. And also the home of the Mennonite Central Committee offices, there were actually two companies that were making components for cluster munitions. And so we felt just a very strong sense of connection to the problem. And we tried very hard to address the issue in Laos because of the problems that it was causing Lao villagers and Lao farmers. But we thought it's not enough just to address the problem after it's happened. We really need to address the problem at its root. So we became very interested to see whether or not there would be a way to limit their use or ban them outright, in much the same way that the world agreed to ban landmines in 1997, although the U.S. has still not signed that treaty. We thought since the effects of a cluster bomb were very similar to landmines, it would be really important for the world to also ban cluster munitions. So we kept talking about the problem and urging other similar organizations like Mennonite Central Committee or landmine ban campaigns and governments to consider the possibility of a ban on cluster munitions. And to make a long story short, finally in 2008, over 100 countries gathered in Norway, Oslo, Norway, and in December of that year, I think it was 94, agreed to sign the treaty at that point. That has now increased now to, I think it's around 108 countries that have acceded to the treaty. Again, the U.S. is not among them.
And that was as recent as 2008.
Right.
And you were involved in some of that activity?
Yes, it's really interesting. The campaign to ban landmines had a lot of involvement from civil society. It was not just governments meeting by themselves making these decisions. It was government meetings and non-governmental organizations meeting alongside those meetings so that you had survivors of landmine accidents, people who lived in communities where landmines were a problem, present and mixing with government delegations who were considering the problem of landmines, confronting them with the details, the effect of landmines on their communities, so that the reality of the landmines would be very present in those government negotiations. And the same thing happened with the cluster bomb advocacy work. I went to many government meetings along with people from the landmine campaigns that were also concerned about cluster munitions, and we kept raising the concern about cluster munitions. We brought people who had survived cluster bomb accidents. We brought photographs from around the world where cluster bombs were a problem. People who were involved in demining, putting their lives on the line to destroy these things, came to government meetings and just engaged in conversation with government delegations. And then finally, Norway led a movement to create a treaty to ban cluster munitions. And over a period of about 18 months to 2 years, beginning in 2007, a treaty was crafted, negotiated, and signed, as I said, in Norway at the end of 2008. So it was a real meaningful thing, having witnessed what happened in Laos years and years ago, to be part of the process that led to an outright ban.
But an outright ban signed by, although a large number of countries, not by the United States.
Not by the United States, not by Russia, China, Israel, Pakistan, and India, some of the larger countries, but signed, I think, by all or perhaps all but one of the NATO allies of the U.S. So the major European countries which have stocks of cluster munitions are currently destroying them and have pledged not to use them again or sell them or produce them.
This is a live program, and we do have a way that listeners can participate. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Titus Peachey, that's P-E-A-C-H-E-Y, Titus is happy to answer your questions as well as mine. You may call this station, no matter where you are in the country, at 1-800-222-9455. Or if you're in the Eastern Illinois, Western Indiana listening area, from Chicago to Indianapolis, you may call 217-333-9455 if it's a local call. And, of course, if it's long distance, a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Before we get back with our guest today talking about cluster bombs and this important issue that's affecting so many people around the world, let me add my voice to those you've heard on this station this afternoon and yesterday. You've heard from Denise and Les and Heather and others about the need for support for this nonprofit public radio station. WIL Radio, Illinois Public Media, depends on your support. In fact, the largest single bunch of money we get comes from our listeners to keep this station on the air and programs like this, Keeping the Faith. The machinery does cost money, as well as the staff to run it of engineers and on-air people. I happen to be a volunteer myself, but most of the other people you hear on this station are paid and need to be. They're professionals, and they make my job as an amateur possible. So if you'd like to make a contribution, do call this number, 217-244-9455. That's 244 to make a pledge, 244-WILL, or you can do it online, willpledge.org. Go to willpledge.org. And when you call, they'll take your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. You can also, of course, send in a check. And there are various promotions to try to encourage you to do this because the station really needs help. And so I encourage listeners who appreciate the depth of these programs here on WILLAM to call and make a pledge, make a gift. I just heard from a listener today, someone who says that the things we talk about on Keeping the Faith are important to her, that she keeps thinking about them long after the 58 minutes are over. Often these are issues that are very important, such as the one we're dealing with today. Well, back to Titus Peachy. Titus, tell me about your name. I mean, this is a very biblical name. Titus.
Yes, my parents chose the name Titus because of the New Testament book named Titus. And, of course, I didn't have any choice with my last name, but it's a German-Swiss derivation. And once those ancestors of mine came to the U.S., the name got changed now and again from various variations. The Peachies and the Beachies, I think, all come from the same Swiss-German stock.
Oh. And were your parents Mennonites?
Yes, they were Mennonite, and I am still a member of a Mennonite church here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
And you work with the Mennonite Central Committee.
That's correct.
And did you never rebel against your Mennonite upbringing and being given a biblical name?
Well, I wouldn't say I rebelled, no. I found a lot of meaning and value in the religious training and church life that I had. The community I grew up in was a very conservative Mennonite community, which had very many conservative outward expressions. I learned to speak Pennsylvania German as a child. We were very conservative in our dress. There was not a lot of support for higher education. So there are many ways in which I have acculturated. I went to college. I still love to speak Pennsylvania German with my brother-in-law on the phone or with my mother when I call, but obviously it's not my regular speech. But the basic spiritual underpinnings and values I still treasure.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Eastern Mennonite College for 2 years, and then that was in 68 to 70. I wasn't real clear on my major. My father encouraged me to take some time off and do something else for a while. So I did, and at that time there was still a military draft during the Vietnam War, and so being a conscientious objector to war, I did alternative service, and I did that in Vietnam for 3 years from 1970 to 1973.
What did you do in Vietnam?
I worked with a Mennonite agency there, and my particular assignment during those 3 years was teaching English to high school and university students in Saigon. In the last couple months that I was there, I worked in a small village in the province of Pleiku up in the Central Highlands, working with a public health nurse on some projects in the tribal village just to give me a bit of a different kind of experience.
You mentioned earlier that the cluster bombs dropped in Laos was part of a secret war that was going
right.
on. Did you, as a conscientious objector, have any idea that was happening in the country next to Vietnam when you were there?
I knew there was bombing going on in Laos. Pleiku province is actually one that borders southern Laos, and we would see B-52 bombers flying north, and some of those were obviously going north to North Vietnam, but some of them also in Laos. But I had no idea that it was such a massive 9-year campaign. Hadn't a clue at the time. Just to finish the college story,
yes,
when I got back to the U.S. then, I finished my college taking most of my courses at Temple University in Philadelphia.
What did you study at Temple?
Social work. I got an undergraduate degree in social work, and that's as far as I've gone.
And did you practice social work in some agency before you got into this more broader definition?
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things I enjoyed about the social work program at Temple was there was a fairly strong emphasis on community organization, which wouldn't be exactly what I was doing since that time, but certainly very much oriented toward looking at structural, systemic issues and not only the interpersonal side of it.
I'd like to let listeners know very quickly how they can respond to this issue. If they would like to add their voice to try to influence U.S. policy to ban cluster bombs and landmines, what can people do?
Well, there's a couple things. Pardon me. There's currently some legislation in Congress called the Cluster Munitions Civilian Protection Act of 2011. And this piece of legislation would limit the use of cluster bombs. It would require the U.S. not to use any cluster bomb that have a higher than 1% failure rate. And it would require them to guarantee that the cluster bombs would be used only against clearly defined military targets. Now, this is not a ban. It's not at all the same as a ban, but it's the one piece, one legislative handle that we have at the moment that we can encourage our representatives and senators to support. It's Senate Bill 558 and House of Representatives Bill 996. So that is one small step that we could ask our government to take. The U.S. Administration, the Obama administration, is currently reviewing its policy on landmines. And so any letters to senators and representatives or to the administration, to President Obama, to Secretary of State Clinton, urging the government to accede to the Treaty on Landmines would also be very helpful. So those are two steps that people could take. Unfortunately, there is no current review of our cluster bomb policy, and there's no legislation that would result in a ban of cluster munitions at this stage. So these are two other things that we can support short of that. One other thing that I've been engaged in, and that is trying to urge the U.S. government to provide more support for bomb clearance in Laos. Since the U.S. was the primary user of bombs in Laos, we've been urging the U.S. government to provide resources for clearance. And the U.S. government has done so. Over the last 15, 16 years, the U.S. has spent around $50 to $55 million for bomb clearance work in Laos. But it has no relationship to the scale of the problem. In that time period, the last 16 years, despite the expenditure of $55 million, only about 500,000 of the cluster munitions have been destroyed. And we think they're probably, based on estimates from the miners, 75 to 80 million of them still there. So we're really urging the U.S. government to spend more resources and to give more support for bomb clearance work in Laos.
And for listeners who'd like to learn more, you have a website that's very helpful, just simply called Cluster Bombs, all one word, .mcc.org.
That's correct.
That's for the Mennonite Central Committee.
Right.
And you kind of keep a watch on that website and make sure it's up to date. And so that's a good place to go. Clusterbombs.mcc.org for more more information. For people who don't have computer access, is there a way to get on a mailing list, or is there a place they could phone for information? Or if
they could certainly phone me, and I would be happy to send them information. I can give you my MCC phone number. It's 717-859-1151, and ask for Titus Peachy. There's only one of me there.
And that's 717-859-1151 during
right.
the week. Ask for Titus.
That's correct.
All right.
And I wanted to give you one more website address that I think would be very helpful, particularly in relation to the problem of cluster munitions in Laos and urging the U.S. government to provide more support. It's called legaciesofwar.org. Legaciesofwar.org. It was begun by a Lao American woman who came to this country as a refugee when she was very young, 6 or 7 years old, and learned about this devastation in her country by the bombing of the U.S. only in her adult years, and has begun a project to urge the government to do more cleanup work in Laos. And it's really been a very effective agency that has actually successfully lobbied the government to increase its support for bomb clearance in Laos over the last year or two. So that's another source of good information.
We're getting close to halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon with our guest, Titus Peachy, who will be speaking this coming Thursday night at 7 p.m. at Latzer Hall at the University YMCA on the campus of the University of Illinois. He is Director of Peace Education for the Mennonite Central Committee, and he'll be giving a lecture about the cluster bombs at the Y. Also, this whole week, there is an exhibit at the Y about cluster bombs called Daily Terror. So if you can find a way to the Y during the week, tonight it's open till 10, for example. Even during the week, it's often possible to park. Since students are in and out for classes a lot, there are often parking spaces available. Do take some quarters along during the week, during the day. After 5, you can park free in university lots, and there's a lot of free parking there, for example, for Thursday night to hear Titus's lecture. The Y is located on Chalmers and Wright Street, right on the edge of the campus. If you take a bus, you can get off right at the University Library, walk half a block, and you're at the University Y. Let me make a few other announcements. Also at the Y, and the Y, incidentally, has provided support for this program for many years here on WILL AM 580. Coming up on Friday Forum at the Y, a noon lecture as part of their series this year on the future of learning, is public education under siege? I was very fortunate to hear the lecture last Friday noon by Richard Arum from New York University, professor of sociology, who talks about the current crisis in higher education in terms of undergraduate actual learning. He's the author of the book Academically Adrift, and the Academically Adrift Study, rather. And it was a wonderful lecture, very, very, very important. Coming up this next week, October 28th, at noon, Friday Forum at the University of Y, Deba Dutta, who's the Associate Provost and Dean of the Graduate College here at the University, will talk about, her topic is Educate to Innovate, a National Imperative. That's October 28th. Professor Deba Dutta. Also at the Y is a art show around the corner from the cluster bomb exhibit posters. Is a very interesting, quite moving art show called Waveland, a meditation. Waveland is a community in Louisiana that suffered under the Hurricane Katrina, and it was one of the few undeveloped areas of the coastline there, but the effects of the hurricane on nature is very poetically seen in a series of photographs by Valerie Oliverio, and that's available to be seen at the Y all this semester through December 23rd. Coming up next Sunday, October 30th at 2 in the afternoon at the Champaign Public Library, will be a free showing of Boudris, a one-hour documentary film about an Arab village's successful diversion of the infamous wall being put through Israel and Palestine. They used nonviolent means to divert that wall from splitting up their community. It's a fascinating documentary film. Again, Champaign Public Library next Sunday, 2 p.m. Even after the discussion, there'll be a panel discussion afterwards. You'll still have time to hear Keeping the Faith next Sunday at 5. The Intercultural Friendship Foundation here at the University of Illinois is sponsoring its 8th annual Dialogue and Friendship Banquet. This is a intercultural, interfaith banquet. It will happen November 3rd, Thursday at 7 p.m. at the I Hotel on campus. It costs $15 per person for dinner. It's usually a very interesting program, and they'll be giving some awards again for interfaith successes. So again, if you are interested in that, you may go to their website. Just go to ifffillinois.org to find out more about how to attend that banquet. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, our guest will be a couple folks talking about spirituals, the very interesting musical form from the African-American community that have a fascinating history. And that's leading to a concert of spirituals by The Chorale, a local group, which will be performing free November 5th at 7 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church. That's, again, November 5th, 7 p.m., Faith United Methodist Church. The Chorale will be singing a whole collection of spirituals under the direction of Julie Byler. Some of the solo work will be done by Elizabeth Buckley. Again, November 5, 7 p.m., a free concert, Faith United Methodist Church. Well, more announcements than usual, but this is a busy time of the year for college students and others. And so keep those in mind. Again, let me remind you, if you'd like to make a pledge to WILL, this nonprofit public station here in East Central Illinois, West Central Indiana, you may do that by calling 217-244-9455 or going to the website willpledge.org. And those numbers are different than to call the studio to speak with our guest today. If you'd like to speak with our guest, Titus Peachy, do call us at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long distance, call 1-800-222-9455. And of course, as always, this program will be archived very soon, usually within a week, so that if you miss part of it, you can hear it online at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And leave the G off of keeping. We're quite informal here. So will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith for this program and other programs on our archive that you can listen to at your convenience via your computer. Well, back to our guest talking about cluster bombs, and we do have a call waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead. Oops, I'm sorry. I didn't quite have the right button pushed. Let me see if I can do this correctly this time.
I'm in Champaign.
Yes, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Peachy, I wanted to know if there are both liberal and conservative Mennonites?
Yes, I guess you could describe us that way. The most conservative Mennonite groups would be similar to, I don't know if you have Amish living in your community. That would be on the very conservative end of the continuum.
Within 50 miles.
Yes, okay. We do have Amish here.
Yeah, we have the same historical roots from Switzerland, but then historically there was a bit of a division And some groups wished to maintain stricter discipline within the communities. Others were willing to become more acculturated. And so you have a broad continuum now of people that have the same historical roots religiously, identifying as Mennonite. But, you know, some of us very much similar to others in terms of careers and professions that we might be engaged in, whereas the more conservative and Amish groups would attain much more separation between their communities and the rest of society in terms of the lifestyle that they lead and the kinds of professions or careers that they would have.
The other question I had is, I have heard a Mennonite choir, and it was just wonderful, and I was wondering if they had a very rich singing tradition.
Well, that's one thing that people who come to Mennonite churches will often comment on, but we do have really a wide range of singing traditions. The traditional groups would often sing four-part harmony. That's what we do in my church. We sang four-part hymns, four-part harmony when I was growing up, and we still do that in the church that I attend today. So for many Mennonites who grew up in that environment, singing is just part of the normal life experience, and it's emphasized in the colleges and schools as well. Mennonites today are from many different cultural groups and ethnic groups, and so, you know, you have Mennonites who sing very, very different kind of styles from four-part harmony. There are African-American churches, Latino Mennonite churches, Indonesian, just Vietnamese, a whole variety of Mennonites in the U.S. and Canada and around the world. So the singing tradition has really is really as diverse as the world, but the more traditional groups use the four-part harmony, which may be what you are familiar with.
Yes, that was what I heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
Yep, you're welcome.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for the call. And, of course, some of the Amish groups and maybe other Mennonites, more conservative, don't use any instrumental music. It's a cappella four-part harmony.
That's correct. And among the Amish, there would be probably not so much four-part harmony as a lead singer lining a line and then the rest of the church following on behind, more like a Gregorian chant in style.
Mm. We have another caller I see on our toll-free line. Well, let's see. I'm not sure that person wants to be on the air. We'll wait just a moment and see. We're talking with Titus Peachy about the problems of cluster bombs. He'll be speaking at the University of Y this Thursday at 7 p.m. if you'd like to meet him in person and talk with him. I noticed, Titus, that you'd had a letter to the editor published in the Philadelphia Inquirer, one of the great newspapers in our country, just in late September on this issue, talking about the White House garden. Share some of your images with our listeners.
Well, I was intrigued by the First Lady Michelle Obama's growing of a garden on the White House lawn. Delighted with that. A lot of good things about that in terms of raising local foods and eating fresh foods and eating healthy foods. And it occurred to me that the people of Laos are very similar. Many of them are farmers, and most of them grow vegetables in their gardens. But farming and gardening in Laos is a very dangerous activity, especially in the areas where there had been heavy bombing. Villagers that go out to work in their fields and gardens often use a traditional Lao hoe to turn the soil. It has a large, heavy blade on the front, and it's swung from high over the head and hits the ground with considerable force. A lot of these cluster bomblets that were dropped, if they were dropped during rainy season when the soil was soft, didn't just land on top of the soil and stay there. They burrowed underneath the soil. They may be underneath the soil a foot or 6 inches or more. And so oftentimes when people are working in their fields and gardens with their hoes, they will accidentally hit one of these buried cluster bombs, which then blows up and injures or kills them. when my wife visited one of the northern provinces in 1981, she was taken to visit a family, and the mother had been hoeing in her garden just the day before when she hit one of these cluster bombs, and the cluster bomb blew up and killed her. The father, the woman's husband, gave the hoe head to Linda and told her to take it back to America to tell the story of the family so that it wouldn't have to happen again. So we've been carrying that hoe head around for the last 30 years. And so in the op-ed piece in the Inquirer, I simply noted that, you know, President Obama and Michelle Obama may be working in their garden. And I urged him to put down his hoe for a second and sign the landmine ban and the cluster bomb treaty so that people would not have to, people around the world would not have to garden in fear of unexploded U.S. bombs. We would all be horrified if, of course, there were bombs in our gardens or bombs in our fields or in our neighborhoods. And I thought that was one way, perhaps, to speak to the president and the president's family, since they were involved in gardening, in a way that might help understand some of the realities around the world.
We have a caller waiting from Normal, Illinois. You're on the air with Titus Peachy.
Oh, thank you very much, Steve. I was wondering if you could announce to your large listening audience that Titus Peachy will also be speaking in Normal on Sunday evening.
Very good. Where will he be speaking?
At the Mennonite Church of Normal.
Where is that?
That's on the corner of Cottage and Hovey, and he'll be speaking on rejecting fire from heaven, working for peace in a time of war.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that information. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Titus, do you know other places you're speaking? Is this sort of a Midwest tour?
Well, I'll be speaking at North Danvers Mennonite Church on Sunday morning, both in the Sunday school time period as well as the Sunday morning sermon at that church. And I'm sorry, I don't have that church address in my head,
okay,
but it's the North Danvers Mennonite Church. And I'll also be doing an interview on WBEZ in Chicago on Friday afternoon, although I think that's taped and will be aired at another time.
Our sister station in Chicago.
Yes.
Great. Let me give the phone numbers again for others who may have a question or a comment or a related event, perhaps. In Champaign-Urbana area, if you're in the 217 area code, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number. Titus, when you travel these days and you go to other countries that have signed the landmark, the landmine treaty, and who have signed the treaty of 2008 about cluster bombs, and you tell them you're from the United States, what do they ask you?
Why doesn't the U.S. sign is the question. I'm often, when I travel to those places, I'm often with people who have been engaged in the landmine or cluster bomb campaigns. And sometimes they'll ask, you know, why the U.S. hasn't signed, and other times they'll just give me sort of a pained look, understanding or empathy with our hard work that we have here to persuade our government to join the world community in that regard. I think in a place like Laos, or Lebanon, where people are very much aware of the problem from the standpoint of having encountered it in their fields and gardens, it's difficult for them to understand why we insist on using weaponry which has been so harmful to their communities. When I was in South Lebanon, and I guess this is another angle or perspective on this issue, which I think is important for us to think about. When I was in South Lebanon in 2007, about a year after the bombardment that Israel visited on Lebanon, and some of those cluster munitions that Israel used were from the U.S., I met a man whose five-year-old son had been killed by a cluster bomb. And it would happen in a public park in South Lebanon. They were actually gathering to celebrate the young child's fifth birthday. And the children went off to play, and all of a sudden there was an explosion. And young Ahmed Mokhaled lost his life. I don't know if that cluster bomb was from the U.S. or not, but it was just a very, very tragic loss of life for a young child to a cluster bomb. And in that kind of an environment where there is already a lot of animosity and resentment, in this case toward Israel and its use of weapons, and many of those weapons coming from the U.S., to have cluster munitions made in the U.S. lying around in those communities simply feeds into an atmosphere of resentment and anger toward the United States. So it feels like it's in our own national security interest not to do that, because in that kind of an atmosphere, in that kind of an environment, that's an atmosphere where terrorism can take root and grow. The father of this young boy, Raed Mokhaled, said he was very angry after the accident happened, but after some time had passed, he decided that he wanted to channel his energy into very positive directions. So he became very involved in the cluster bomb ban campaign. He actually joined a delegation to the U.S. organized by Mennonite Central Committee. And I traveled with him throughout the Northeast here and also in the Midwest so that he and several cluster munition survivors from Laos could tell their stories. And I admired his decision and his commitment to, you know, channel that anger into something positive, but obviously not everyone makes that choice. And so I think it's important not only for humanitarian reasons, but even just for national security reasons, it's important that the U.S. sign the cluster bomb ban and not continue to have U.S. cluster munitions destroying the lives of people and creating that kind of resentment and atmosphere in other countries.
And again, for listeners who'd like to join in providing some political education to legislators, Senate Bill 558 and House Bill 996 currently in Washington would at least be limiting the use of cluster bombs. And, of course, encouragement to join the ban for landmines and cluster bombs that many other countries have joined. Information about that can be found at clusterbombs.mcc.org. That's Mennonite Central Committee. clusterbombs.mcc.org for information. Could you give us any statistics, Titus, about how many people are still being affected, whether it's in Laos or maybe all around the world or Lebanon, wherever, by cluster bombs that have been dropped before, Iraq, or are there just too many thousands to count?
It varies from country to country. I think in Laos post-war, they estimate around 30,000 casualties from cluster munitions, and that number has dropped in recent years, up until a year or two ago.
You're talking per year?
Per year. No. Total no, since total. The end of the war, 30,000.
Okay, so it's declining per year.
It's declining
year.
Now.
Right.
I think a couple of years ago, for a long time, it was averaging a bit over 300 casualties a year, and I think the last year it was down 150 or so. I don't know the exact number. I don't have figures for Iraq and Lebanon. I went to Iraq in 2004 to see whether or not Mennonite Central Committee might find some way to respond to the problem there. And that was just before it really became very difficult to continue working as a U.S. citizen in Iraq. So we were not able to follow up on the various leads that we had. But I visited areas of northern Iraq and areas of Baghdad where cluster bombs had been used, spoke to people who had been injured by them, saw cluster bombs in a wheat field. So it's an ongoing problem, but I don't have worldwide figures in my head.
We have another caller waiting from Eureka. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead.
I guess maybe this is a rather simplistic question, but I guess the cluster bombs were used in every country that was involved in the Vietnam War, I guess Cambodia.
Yes.
also, plus Vietnam. Was Vietnam the greatest concentration of cluster bombs?
The greatest concentration was Laos. I think next was Vietnam and next Cambodia, if I remember correctly. But Laos had the most.
And I remember hearing this, and I've heard it many times, and I think it'd be true. Could you verify it? I believe the figure, I don't know the exact tonnage, but it was said that the United States dropped as much tonnage in bombs in Indochina as was dropped in World War II. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, I think it is. I've heard that as well. I don't have the exact tonnage in my head either, but I've heard that comparison made many times, yes.
Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you for your call. Again, we're talking with Titus Peachey, who will be speaking at the Y this Thursday night at 7 p.m. about cluster bombs. There's also a display there of information, even today, all this week, about how people can respond to this issue of these weapons.
If I could give just one further illustration of the number of bombs or bombing missions in Laos. We did some calculations when we returned from Laos and looked up the records from the Senate log after they had hearings, and there were 580,000 U.S. bombing missions in Laos over a nine-year period. And if you average that out over the 9 years, it would be the equivalent of one bombing mission every 8 minutes round the clock for 9 years. So that gives you some sense of the incredible, massive effort that was given in order to bomb this small country, which had at the time 3 million people.
I am not a pacifist. I think there may be some wars which might be defensible if they're defensive and fought only against combatants and with appropriate weapons for self-defense in order to stop. Stop rampaging violence. So maybe it's not fair for me to ask a pure pacifist this question, but when you're talking about weapons and bombs, I mean, don't you want them to kill a lot of people?
Well, certainly that's the whole point. That's the whole purpose, and that's what a military person would say. But I think even military people would not want to be killing civilians, and they would not have as part of their objective that children 30 years later would still be dying from the weapons they're dropping. There's no military value in that. There's no military purpose for that. So at least for this particular kind of weapon, goes far beyond any kind of military utility or military purpose in terms of its effect, and that's certainly illustrated by its use everywhere it's been used. It has had the same effect, and I assume a military person would say that the whole point of using the weapon, using a lethal weapon, is to achieve a military objective, destroy tanks, destroy military equipment, and destroy soldiers. There's no military point in killing civilians and in killing children years later.
We have another caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hello. Titus, I am with the Wesley United Methodist Church Social Action Ministry. And we have a community bulletin board, and I'd like to put up any information that we could get, flyers on this issue. I don't know if you have any, but if you do, I can stop by the Y and pick them up. And also, do you know anything if those bells are still available that they had? They were selling them at a shop here in 10,000 Villages. That were made from landmines to help buy prosthetic legs and arms for children who got hit by them.
Yeah, I was aware of jewelry. I wasn't aware of bells, but it's quite possible that they were also selling bells. I wouldn't be able to say if the particular store you're referring to still has them, but I am aware that there is a line of jewelry made from expended war material. From those countries.
Oh. Okay.
And people could check at 10,000 Villages,
right.
Downtown Champaign for for those items.
Are there any flyers that I could pick up at the Y?
Are you talking about flyers referencing my
cluster
presentation
bomb.
Thursday,
yeah.
Or just flyers about cluster bombs in general?
Your presentation and, and also the House and Senate bills.
There are postcards that came with the display for people mm-hmm. to use to send to their representatives and senators.
Okay.
And I don't know how quickly they will disappear, but I could certainly arrange to make sure that you get additional copies. If you would want to send an email to tmp@mcc.org, then I could be in direct communication with you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your call. And other people who'd like to get more information may use that that email address or your phone number, which you kindly gave earlier, 717-859-1151. For more information, that would be during business hours.
Right.
And your website, again, would have information that people can download, clusterbombs.mcc.org. Uh-huh. And at the Why the Daily Terror exhibit, those posters, there's also handouts that people can take that have information about how they can respond to this with postcards or letters or phone calls to legislators. Titus, we are out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us on this Sunday evening from Pennsylvania, and thank you for your work, and I hope you have a good turnout Thursday night here and at Normal, Illinois, that next Sunday.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be talking about spirituals from the African-American religious tradition, that wonderful musical form that leads up to a concert that's coming November 5th at the Faith United Methodist Church at 7 p.m. by The Chorale. Our spiritual connection, guest soloist Elizabeth Buckley, many spirituals will be sung by this 60-person community chorale under the direction of Julie Byler. So on October 30, we'll be talking about spirituals that will be leading up to that November 5 free concert at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign on Prospect Avenue. Again, a reminder of the movie Boudris, which will be shown at the Champaign Public Library Sunday, October 30. That's next Sunday at 2 p.m. It's a free showing of a documentary about an Arab village's successful diversion of the wall through nonviolent means. Also at the Y this Friday Forum, Educate to Innovate, a National Imperative, Professor Deba Dutta, Provost and Dean of the Graduate College at the University, as part of the series on the future of learning as public education under siege. Also at the Y is an art show called Waveland. It's available to be seen anytime the Y is open. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
You listen to WILL every day because you find something here that appeals to you. Whether you tune in for Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Focus, or the Daily Agricultural Markets, WILL brings you the programs you enjoy throughout your day. It's radio that appeals to your love of learning, your desire for information. This is our fall pledge drive at WILL. Your contribution helps support these programs. Please take a moment now and make a contribution online at willpledge.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
This is Illinois Public Media.